You know, it'd been weekends, working nonstop. This case being in the back of your mind, no matter what, brushing your teeth, taking a shower, going to a sports event for your kids.
I think this intentional killing of his child was to rid himself of a burden. And he wanted to have the freedom to obviously do these kinds of things, unburdened.
There was a tremendous burden, a weight on everybody in this office.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds, as well as creator of Discovery's Manhunt Unabomber. And today with me, live from Atlanta, is...
Hi, guys. It's Francie Hakes. How are you, Jim?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice, Francie.
Thanks.
It's great to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. I'm sorry I'm at a distance, but I'm in Atlanta for a very special reason. We have a couple of very special guests today. I'm live with them in the Cobb County District Attorney's office. We have the elected district attorney, Vic Reynolds, and the deputy chief district attorney, deputy chief assistant district attorney, right? Chuck Boring, who is the head of the Special Victims Unit.
Okay, why don't we talk about the trial itself, picking a jury and getting started in this case?
Well, one of the things that I followed as just an outsider interested in a variety of ways, but part of it was because I knew the entire trial team, you guys, you and Jesse Evans, for your office, and the two main defense attorneys, Maddox Kilgore and Brian Lumpkin, I worked with right here in this office in Cobb County myself. So I followed the case even more interestedly than I would have otherwise. And I do know that jury selection in and of itself was an incredibly dramatic, mostly because you had all sorts of motions to move the case outside of Cobb County because of all the publicity. So I know that you had to try the case in a far off district, away from home, away from your family. How did that go?
For me, it was interesting because I'd lived this case for a while leading up to the first attempt to get a jury here in Cobb County. So, you know, it'd been weekends, working nonstop. This case being in the back of your mind, no matter what, brushing your teeth, taking a shower, going to a sports event for your kids. We thought, okay, we're going to get started. And we were in jury selection for almost a month. And then a motion was filed by the defense to change venue. And only at that point, when the judge decided to change venue, it really kind of hit a day or two after that this was going to be even more of a life-changing event. And so just something, things you wouldn't even think of. We had to take a trip down to the location to where a venue was changed, which was hundreds of miles away, to find where we were going to live, how are we going to live? What are we going to do with our families? How is that going to be taken care of? I had at the time, I've got three children now. My wife, our youngest, was not even a year old when I left to go down to the coast to try this case. So it was a lot of the dynamics and the logistics of that were really, it bore down on us, and it was stressful leading up to it before we got down there. So it
well,
was,
and Vic, I don't mean to bring money and resources into it, but that is, of course, the bane of the existence of every district attorney's office that I've ever worked for or talked to, and that is always too many cases, not enough bodies to handle them all. There's so much business to do here, and crime never stops. Now you have a case where you've got ADAs who are going to be away from their family outside of this office and cut off from their normal resources. That is, their legal assistants, their researchers, investigators. How did you deal as the DA with some of those issues? I mean, when I was working here, if I had a problem during trial, I literally cross the street and I'm in the DA's office. So if I needed help, I needed quick research on something, I didn't know an answer, I could get it quickly. How did you handle that?
Well, one of the things that we had decided to do, and I certainly had decided as the elected, is that I was not going to let financial restraints affect the ultimate seeking of justice on behalf of Cooper. That was our goal, and something we talked about from the very beginning of this case is that our desire and our goal in this case was singular in nature, and that was just to make sure that we had achieved justice on behalf of Cooper. And so when we put together the trial team, Chuck was the point person on it, and Jesse Evans and Susan Treadaway were the other two prosecutors. And as Chuck said a moment ago, all three of these folks, including Chuck, have small children, young children, they have families. They were packing up and leaving these families. But not only the lawyers went, we sent an investigator down, we sent an administrative assistant down, we sent a victim's advocate down, and those folks were there from the beginning until the end. Besides those individuals, we would send additional investigators down when needed. We would send interns down to do research when needed. We had decided that regardless of what it took, in the end, we wanted to present the evidence as we knew it to be and let 12 folks decide. Would we have liked to have them decide it here where we could take an elevator and run up to the courtroom? Sure. But we knew in the back of our mind there was a good chance this case would be moved, probably should have been moved. The dilemma with moving a case is we can't ask for it. The judge can't ask for it. The defense has to ask for it. And so when they did finally ask for it, as Chuck said, after about a month of trying to get a jury here, Her Honor didn't have much of a choice except to do that. And so we steeled ourselves up with that decision. We realized once it was made what we were going to have to do. We began the process of helping find a place, a comfortable place that these individuals could be, because they were going to be living there. They were going to pick their lives up. They were going to transport it down to a county on the coast of Georgia, over 300 miles away from here, and try this case. And having done that on a couple of occasions myself, I realized what it took to do that, the tough dilemma and situation it put you in, being away from your family and your comfort level. But again, these folks are professionals, and these prosecutors, the investigator, the advocate, the administrative assistant, all knew what they were getting into, and they packed up, went down, and did their job.
You said something about not being able to pick a jury for a month, trying for a month to pick a jury. So can you tell, since Francie and I try to take people behind police lines, can you tell us what the difficulty was? Why weren't you able to pick a jury during that time?
And that's a question for you, Chuck.
The difficulty here was a lot of the level of media attention. Not just generally this case happened, but a lot of details, both accurate and inaccurate, that were flooding the media from the time this happened leading up to the trial. I mean, if there was a day didn't pass, it seemed like sometimes, without some angle or some reporting on the case by one of the media outlets, and it just kind of overwhelmed the area. So once we started with jury selection, we had questionnaires, and there were very strong opinions even from the jump. And so what we were trying to do is see if we could find jurors who could put whatever feelings or opinions they had formed aside and decide the case based solely on the evidence and the law in the courtroom and not what they'd heard. And there were a lot of jurors who had already formed very, very strong opinions about the case just from the media aspect of it.
And which way were those opinions running, would you say? Were they for Ross Harris or against?
There were a majority of them were negative opinions against him. Definitely, I think that was kind of a theme through the questionnaires. Now, once you got to questioning some of the jurors individually, there were a lot of jurors who had thoughts and perceptions and preconceived notions the other way about believing that somebody could actually do this. But the majority of what we found here in Cobb County was that the media had flooded it locally. And then what we found when we actually moved to Brunswick and started doing jury selection there on the coast, people knew generally about the case, but not a lot of the jurors knew the details of it. And so while people may have known about it, there are a number of jurors who just had not formed an opinion either way in the case.
So you have a jury, you start the trial the way trials start, with opening statements and then presenting evidence. One of the things I'm interested in addition to, of course, how you dealt with just the difficulty of presenting evidence in a child homicide by the child's father is how you dealt with colleagues. I know that you knew Maddox, Kilgore, and Brian Lumpkin quite well. And so how did you deal with having lawyers who were former prosecutors on the other side?
Well, I think in one regard, knowing them and being able to communicate helped streamline some of the process, because we would talk and, you know, if there were fights that didn't need to be fought that we were going to agree on, we could do that well ahead of time. So I think that kind of helped. And also, one thing is we didn't have to worry about the defense attorneys not knowing the law. We knew that they knew what it was, no matter what they were going to position they were going to have to take. They've been doing it a long time. So I don't think it made it that difficult having previous, you know, known them and worked with them in the past. You know, I don't think it made it more difficult, but it was an interesting dynamic.
Well, and I think you said something really interesting that I don't think the public generally thinks about, and that is you were glad to have lawyers on the other side who knew the law. And as a former prosecutor, one of the worst things, and people will be so shocked to hear this, one of the worst things that could happen is when you got one of those defense attorneys that didn't know what they were doing, or when you had a defendant who wanted to work, you know, be his own lawyer, because then you feel like you have to do that defense attorney's job in order to protect whatever outcome there is in the case, whether it's a guilty plea or a conviction after trial. And I think most people don't really appreciate that prosecutors actually really want the other side to know what they're doing. It's much better for justice in the end.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. No doubt whatsoever.
So tell us a little bit about some of the most difficult things that happened during the trial. What do you think were the biggest challenges, other than trying to get justice for Cooper generally? But what do you think the biggest challenges were?
One of the challenges was just logistics in having to have a case that all of the evidence, witnesses were located in Cobb County, and making the logistical plans for them to be brought here, the evidence to be brought down to the courtroom. That was difficult. A lot of it, because there were numerous witnesses who this case impacted them greatly, even as just witnesses and peripheral witnesses. A lot of it was social work, you know, trying to make sure these people were comfortable doing what you could to make it as easy as possible for getting them down there, getting them to the stand, getting them through talking about what they had witnessed and what they had been through, and then, you know, kind of dealing with the aftermath for them. So that was difficult. That's a good point. Yeah, we also had a hurricane.
Oh, because you're on the coast of Georgia.
Yeah, yes. About 3 days after keep in mind, I'm just going to go ahead. I know people were complaining throughout this case about somebody coughing and trying to mess up the prosecutors during the people would watch it online. That was actually me coughing the whole time. So, yeah, I had chronic bronchitis the whole time I was down there. Magically, it cleared up while the jury was out. In addition, a real actual hurricane came and hit the coast about 3 days, 4 days after we started the case. So we had to evacuate. And so we pulled up stakes, had to grab all our evidence, grab everything, and drive back to Atlanta or in middle Georgia. Some people did to escape the hurricane. The jurors left and it flooded Brunswick. Our house, we couldn't get on the area we were staying. Once we started back to trial, our area still was, you couldn't get to it. So we had to find hotels in a different area and basically live out of our cars for a couple of days while that happened. So that was also a difficulty. Thank you for reminding me, Vic. I think I blocked that out. It's like PTSD.
Hurricanes are probably not something that Georgia prosecutors anyway generally have to deal with in the case. So in addition to the hurricane, one of the things that I think would have been the most difficult was cross-examining the defendant's wife, Cooper's mom, because of her obvious hostility toward the state's case, the fact that you couldn't talk to her ahead of time. I imagine that means you didn't have a whole lot of prior statements from her to compare. You had no idea what she was going to say, but she is the mother of the child who's dead. So you have to really be careful. That's such a delicate balance. How did y'all handle that?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely a delicate balance. I think to prepare in addressing that testimony, you know, she did make an initial statement to the police. We knew a lot from what we gleaned from the forensics of the computers and the defendant's phone and things of that nature about how their relationship was, what she did or did not know leading up to the day of the child's murder. So we had some idea going in, but it was tough to go in there and be able to cross-examine her without, you know, you don't want to come off as a jerk, but you also want to do justice for this child and you want the truth to be out there. And so there were some tough questions that had to be asked. And a lot of it was questions that weren't so much up for opinion, but just facts that were part of the record and that we found in our investigation that showed that she did not know her husband like she thought she knew. And she did not know that he was living this completely separate life that she was used to with him at home and her child.
Well, let's talk about that just a tiny bit. It's we've sort of presumed, I think, up to now, you gave a summary in the beginning about the child being left in the car and dying, but we sort of presumed a lot of our listeners may be familiar with the case. But for those who aren't, what kind of evidence did you present to the jury that ultimately led to the verdict in this case?
There were a number of things from just the proximity of the location he left, where the car seat was. When he pulled into the parking space, he actually backed up beforehand. He did not have a rear parking camera or backup camera in the car. He stayed in the car some 30 seconds or a little over 30 seconds after parking it with that child sitting right beside him before he got out and walked in. We have video of that. One of the most damning pieces of evidence they found by happenstance going through the video, the defendant left this completely out of his statement to the police and his history to the police. He actually went back to the car at lunch. He had gone to Home Depot to ostensibly, he did purchase light bulbs, was dropped off by his friends at the car and stopped by his car to put light bulbs in his car, opened the door and threw light bulbs into the car. Obviously, who in the heck throws light bulbs in a car? Opened the door, and you see on video, he does that, opens the door and almost seems to, as he has a clear view as he goes up to the car, opens the door, and then as he goes in, he kind of turns his head, it appears. Video's grainy. Then you've got him walking away from the car and a passerby coming by. And as that passerby walks by toward his car, he pauses and stops and appears to, again, it's grainy. It appears to stop and peer over his shoulder. That was subject of a lot of argument. But regardless, he stopped as somebody approached that car after he went into it. That child very well, per the testimony of trial, could have been alive at that point and in a very bad condition or could have been deceased. The fact that he left at the end of the day, got in the car and drove for miles, for minutes, not noticing his child sitting inches away from him. We had numerous detectives, crime scene analysts who processed the car, talked about the stench in the car that he would have noticed in there. The demeanor, he had actually viewed a video 5 days before he left Cooper in the car about the dangers of leaving an animal in the car. A veterinarian on YouTube had talked about it and basically described how the life of a living being could be burnt out of a living being if left in the car, even with the windows cracked for minutes. He viewed that five days before Cooper's death. There's several other things, including he was leading a double life, as we argued to the jury. On the day in question, he had been messaging from the early morning hours up until that afternoon, over 30 people on online applications, most of them women, most of them sexual in nature, sending pictures of himself. Some of these women were people he'd had affairs with.
Wait.
Yes.
So what you're saying is while his child is burning up to death in a car, he is sexting women at work.
That's correct.
Wow. And
Jim, tell me what you think about that behavior.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Well, I think it's probably stress-induced. In other words, he knows exactly what's happening. It could be eustress, knowing in his mind that things are going to get better for him. I think this intentional killing of his child was to rid himself of a burden. And he wanted to have the freedom to obviously do these kinds of things unburdened by a 22-month-old child. So it's either the distress, knowing that this was going on and kind of weighing on him, which then causes extreme behavior, or the eustress, which is that he's looking forward to, this is all working out, this is all going according to plan. This way I can get what I actually want, which is to be able to fool around. So again, you get those same kind of extreme behaviors whenever somebody's under stress, whether it's good stress or bad stress.
Yeah, and the thing about it, this wasn't something where I know a lot of people have tried to say this is, you know, just because somebody is, you know, is cheating on their spouse, you know, that doesn't mean they're a killer.
Absolutely not.
But when you've got somebody that commits such a horrific act as we alleged he had done intentionally, you probably want to find out what the motive was. And in this case, this wasn't just infidelity. Evidence showed this was absolute obsession. Having sexual relations, the evidence showed, with even other members of the men in public locations, people he'd never met before. Basically, the evidence bore out that this was something that really occupied his time and was his central goal. And it was in the midst of that, funny enough, with the FBI, you're talking about your former job, we had consulted with them a bit, just kind of getting some advice on the personality types. And then also regarding technology, we went back and had reviewed our forensics on the defendant's cell phone. Initially, it had been done on one version of the tool that we used. And after talking to the FBI, they said, well, maybe you want to use a different tool just to show this. It's showing the same thing. You're getting the correct times, the correct information. And in that midst, after talking to them, we realized there was an update to our tool that we were using. When we got that update, we were able to get messages from an app that we were not initially able to parse out. And when we did, we found evidence that the defendant on this one app had responded to a post that morning while sitting at Chick-fil-A with his son minutes before he left him in the car. That post had been posted by a female in the Atlanta metro area, and the post said, I hate being married with kids. The novelty is worn off, and I have nothing to show for it. Not only did he view that, we were able to prove that. With the new version of the technology, we were able to show that he engaged in a conversation with this person while at Chick-fil-A, and 10 minutes before locking that child in the car, he typed the words, I love my son and all, but we both need escapes.
Wow. That's pretty damning.
That's like bombshell evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when that came out and it being debated in the media, and I know that Brian and Maddox argued against the evidence itself and then against what it meant and whether it really meant anything. Vic, while all this is going on and while you've got half your office, it sounds like, down on the coast of Georgia, did you feel like you should go down and monitor the trial? I mean, is that the kind of thing you do as the DA?
Well, you certainly have daily conversations, Chuck and I. We had a schedule where you know, sometime in the evening we would talk. I was down there frequently. I was down 3 or 4 times before the jury came back. But one of the things that I really firmly believe in, particularly with folks, the level of experience of someone like Chuck, is that they know how to try a case. They know, he literally lived this case for the couple of years that we had to get it ready to try. It got to the point at the end where this is all he did. He did no other work. You know, we're fortunate here. You know, this is a staff of about 130 folks, so it's a big office, and we can cover everything when we send a team down. But this was the key focus of this office. It was certainly the biggest case that we had handled in my term as district attorney. But I had a very good team, a very experienced team. I don't believe in micromanaging that team. When something came up, Chuck would reach out to me. You know, Vic, this is what we have. We would talk at the end of every day. You know, how did the day go? Do we think we won this day? How did the evidence go up? How did the witnesses do? How was cross-examination? Things of that nature. So we would discuss that daily. We would discuss it on Friday over the weekend to make sure we thought the week had went well. The next week was set up. When they needed something, they would reach out to us. We did our best to make sure everything that they needed, they had. I was down there again, you know, when jury was selected. I was down there for opening. I was down there for part of some of the evidence, certainly for closing, for verdict, things of that nature. But in the end, you know, my job is to put together the best team for this particular case, to trust them to go do the job, and then get the hell out of their way and let them go do it. And that's exactly what we tried to do.
Well, that's so interesting, Vic, that you say that, you know, that I know Chuck lived the case, and I know that, of course, he couldn't do any other work. He's literally not even in the jurisdiction during the trial of the case. But when I was an assistant DA, and I'm sure this happens with Chuck on most or many of his cases, or at least your other ADAs, it happens to the non-supervisory ones, where you may be in trial on a case, but you have another 60 or 100 or 200 or 400 cases that are pending. I mean, I remember sitting for trial calendars, and I was a specialist, so I was crimes against children. I'd be sitting in front of Judge Nix, in front of Judge Nix's courtroom, and his trial calendar had 110 cases on it. And my caseload itself on that trial calendar was about 15 or 20. And I had no idea on that Monday morning whether they'd get to my case or any of my cases were going to trial. So I just want our listeners to know that while that is obviously a special situation for a case like this, that is not the way it is in normal DA's offices. You do not have one case at a time. These guys are absolutely putting out, and girls, are putting out fires on a daily basis and just running like crazy with their hair on fire.
Yeah, this office, you know, as I said a moment ago, we're 750,000 people. And, you know, we'll deal with anywhere between 5,000, 5,500 felonies a year in this office. And that's not counting revocations or anything of that nature. That's just counting new business coming through the door. And these are busy, busy, busy lawyers. But, you know, one thing that I'd really try to emphasize, particularly to Chuck as he went down to do the Harris case, is that this is what you do right here. The rest of this stuff up here in the office, we'll take care of it. We had good trial line lawyers who were picking up some of his cases while he was gone. And we wanted that case, our journey, our desire, our ultimate goal to reach and obtain justice for Cooper Harris was the only focus we wanted Chuck and his team to have down there. And we think we were able to set that situation up where that's all they did.
Yeah, well, I have to agree, Francie, with what you had said. When I was a prosecutor in New York City, I had 200 cases in my caseload. And there were many days where 10 or 15 of them were scheduled for hearing or trial. And you didn't know until the judge actually went through their calendar that particular day whether or not you were going to actually start a trial in her or his courtroom. And unfortunately, that's not the best way to do things because you can't be extremely prepared on 10 or 15 cases at the same time. It's really part of the fact that the prosecution side of this justice equation is overly burdened. And unfortunately, that's basically based on money. They can't hire enough people to cover all the cases. Isn't that true?
That's absolutely true. And Chuck, I mean, I know you have found that to be the case. You've been in the ADA for a long time. How do you deal with that?
It becomes easier and harder the older you get. I can deal with my cases pretty well as far as juggling and making decisions quickly. However, in having a caseload in addition to supervising the other attorneys, now it's a lot of with the younger attorneys having to deal with their questions, you know, but it's just part of the job. But it is, you've got to be somewhat schizophrenic and be able to multitask and juggle things and kind of, you know, make decisions quickly.
I always called working in the DA's office like working in a MASH unit, you know, like the old, I'm showing my age here, but the old TV show MASH, where they called it meatball surgery, where all you have time to do is the best you can. You take whatever the most serious cases, you take the case that's right in front of you, you deal with it, and then you just move on. I had the luxury as a federal prosecutor of having weeks to prepare for a case that was always set in advance. So I knew what case was going to trial, and I never had that kind of high caseload. I got really spoiled, and I'm certain that now I could never go back to being an ADA because I'm not sure I could handle that kind of stress and the cases anymore. But Chuck, back to the Ross Harris case, you guys have put up evidence. You've talked a lot about some of the interesting evidence and then some of the kind of things that you found after using the additional forensic tools that I categorize as a bombshell, really, because now you've got motive. And his conversation with the woman while he was at Chick-fil-A seems to me to be instant motive. Like that maybe set his mind, okay, now I'm going to do it now. This is the day. How long was the jury out deliberating after you put up all of this really significant evidence?
Well, they were out several days. The defense actually put up several days of testimony themselves. I think on some of their witnesses, what we were able to get out through cross-examination actually helped our case. Some expert testimony, things of that nature. So once the jury got it after closing, they were out, it was about 3.5 days. It was on the fourth day of deliberation, they came back with a verdict.
So let's talk a little bit about how you feel when a jury is out. I know for me, those were always the worst moments because you can't do anything else. You can't think about anything else. You're anxious. You're second guessing everything you've done. You wonder if your closing arguments were enough. You feel so responsible. I always felt so responsible, especially the defense put up evidence, so they heard from you last. You feel so responsible for justice for Cooper. How does that 3.5 day period affect you, you know, emotionally as a prosecutor?
Well, honestly, I think your mind starts playing tricks on you. You start thinking, oh, did I hear something? Did we get word? Did somebody come? Do we have a verdict? Do we have a question? You're antsy, there's no doubt about it. But as long as this trial, because how long it had taken, we knew it was a marathon. They had over 1,000 pieces of evidence to go through. I think we'd steeled ourselves for the fact that they were going to be out a while. We knew it was going to take a while for them to get organized. But as it wore on, you know, we got a little, we got antsy and decided to start doing a lot of walking, a lot of touring downtown Brunswick. Just walking around.
And for those of our listeners who've never been to downtown Brunswick, it can't take more than about, I don't know, 5 minutes to walk around downtown Brunswick.
There was a lot of walking in circles, you know, trying to, okay, I grew up playing baseball. I'm superstitious. Okay, well, maybe if I take off my jacket now, maybe something will happen. Or maybe if I leave now, we'll get an answer. So that was very stressful. But then you also, at some point, you decide to start doing other things, maybe do other work to distract yourself from it. In fact, funny story, kind of in hindsight funny, as we were sitting there in our conference room that the DA's office in Brunswick had graciously allowed us to use, they were great hosts. I was sitting about 5 feet from Vic. And so we're talking about, you know, personnel and courtrooms. And I'm sending an email to him, so I'm not watching my phone. And somebody at the other end of the table was like, oh, you know, the news is reporting there's a verdict. And so I looked at my phone. I was like, oh, yeah, I've missed a few calls.
Wow.
So, yeah. So
I
found out a few minutes after the media did that we had a verdict. So I was trying to do office work. But anyway, so at that point, we went down to get the verdict.
And so what happens? I mean, one of the things that I think, obviously, the criminal justice system has a lot of drama. TV, it's one of the things that TV gets right, is crime is dramatic. And that moment, the verdict moment, I think a lot of people remember the O.J. Simpson verdict. and where they were when they were watching the verdict and the defendant stands and, you know, the jury files in. And it is a dramatic moment. And I'll never forget all the times. It was a good thing I didn't have a heart condition, because as the jury's filing in, as you're getting, as the clerk or the judge are getting ready to read the verdict, however they do it, my heart would just be pounding. I could feel it pounding in my chest. Do you have the same experience, or are you calmer than I was?
I think outwardly I'm calm, but no, I think everybody is, a lot of people that do this. But no, inside you definitely have that feeling like, you know, everything is magnified, and it's almost like all the oxygen in the room sucked out of it while you sit, everybody's basically holding their breath to see what happens.
And what happened?
They returned a verdict of guilty on all counts, from malice murder on down. So we knew once they rendered a verdict on the first count, malice murder, that it was probably going to be guilty on all counts.
Well, and for those listeners, malice murder is what we call in Georgia. It's basically like first degree murder in other states. It just means an intentional premeditated killing.
Absolutely.
So what kind of sentence does that carry?
The possibility can be life without parole, life with the possibility of parole. Those are the two sentences, unless you're seeking the death penalty in a murder case. So in this case, he was looking at life without parole, life with the possibility of parole. And then with the other non-homicide related counts, those could be anywhere 20 years, 10 years. So he was looking at a lot of time.
And the judge in this case, if I'm not mistaken, was Judge Mary Staley. Is that right?
Yes.
And for our listeners who aren't familiar with local jurisdiction, Judge Mary Staley, at least in my day, was known as the Velvet Hammer. She is the epitome of a Southern woman. She seems very genteel, and she's very intelligent, and she's very firm. But it always seemed a little shocking when she would impose a very tough sentence, because she just seemed like she's so sweet that she can't really do it. But that's why they called her the Velvet Hammer, because she absolutely can. So what did she impose in this case?
Well, she imposed, it was a life without parole sentence. And I think based on a jury finding this man had intentionally killed his child in that manner, we argued that that was the only just sentence in this case.
And as a result of that verdict, did you ever have an opportunity to present your side of the story to the public, having gone through that period where you had to be, it was forced silence?
Well, you know, it's still, we're not going to go out and argue our case to the public. I think we basically speak on what is public record on the case, because there are still appellate rights, and just, I think it's the right thing to do, because we do, in any event, try to try our case in the courtroom. And I think, you know, because the case was followed so closely by the media, anybody who wants to see any part of the case or wants to follow it or check it, they can. So, you know, I think, honestly, we addressed a lot of it, how it was to go through the case, what we put into it, and, you know, our feelings on the verdict. But, you know, we didn't have to go out and campaign and make a big argument to the media about, you know, we told you. It was kind of, we let the evidence speak for itself.
Well, and Vic, that brings up a great point. Jim brings up a great point, because, of course, we started this off with you talking about the disapproval and maybe even outright hatred, negativity that you faced as the elected DA when the charges were brought in the case. What I'd like to know is whether or not you ever heard the opposite from people. Did anybody ever bother to say, oh, we were wrong, or you were right, or we're glad you're doing your job? Or did you ever get, you know, that sort of reverse side of that coin in the publicity?
You know, we began going back just a little bit when, despite the negative perception at the beginning of the case, as soon as we had the preliminary hearing in this matter, public perception began changing. Literally within a news cycle, it began changing. But again, I don't say this in a flippant way. I don't say it in a way to for any gratitude or anything of that nature. But at the end of the day, what people thought about the case was just not a factor in any decision that I made as the elected. It just wasn't. This is a great job, and I want to be DA for a little while longer. But I don't want to be the DA. I don't make a decision based on wanting to be the DA. I don't make a decision based on getting reelected as a DA. I make a decision based on what facts and law tell me. At the day the verdict came in, we addressed the media, and I I told the media that day, today is not a day that we celebrate. It's not a victory that we're joyous in. It's a day that the goal of achieving justice for Cooper Harris was reached, and that's the only thing we tried to do in this case. And Chuck said a moment ago, as a prosecutor, if you do this job the correct way, you do it with integrity, you follow the facts and the law, then your statement is made inside the four walls of a courtroom.
Well, and that's such a great point, Vic. I mean, for me, I can't think of a single case where I ever exulted in the verdict. You know, you feel a tremendous relief when it's over, especially when you feel that justice has been served, obviously. But that was the feeling I felt, because ultimately Cooper Harris is still dead. That child's life was taken. And it's very difficult to feel sort of that exultance that you see on television when prosecutors, you know, high-fiving. That offends me more than anything else when I see it portrayed that way, because that's not how real prosecutors feel, because there's nothing to high five about. You haven't won. I mean, sure, you won a verdict, but you haven't won. Justice has won. And I think that's the distinction. What do you think about that, Chuck?
Absolutely. It's, you know, when you hear about things or you see, sometimes you may see a young prosecutor get excited or make some reaction like that. Honestly, if I see that, I know they're not fit. They probably don't have a long career in this job, because that's not why people who do this job for the right reason do it. So I think people who are, as yourself, and people who are real prosecutors, know that, you know, not only is it going to impact, you know, you're getting justice for this child who's no longer alive, but there are also people, even the defendant may have family members who are good people. They're impacted. They've lost a loved one. No matter what they've done, they still care for that person. You have law enforcement who are going to have to, the people who tried to revive this little kid, the road officers who showed up on scene and had to stare into that child's face, trying to bring life back to this child. They've got to live with it. So no, you're right. Nobody celebrates what happened. I think it is just a relief that justice was served.
So I'd like to hear from both of you, Chuck and Vic, why this is your best case and your worst case.
Why don't we start with you, Chuck?
I would say best case, because I think it personally made me a better prosecutor. Having to deal with things I've never had to deal with before, there were so many different angles from a legal, practical standpoint, you know, that you're never going to see in your career unless you have one or two of these type of cases. Best case also because it was the most innocent of victims being able to, when nobody else was there on his side other than the state's, you know, our employees, been able to get justice for that child and speak for him. So I think in that regard, that was the best case, one of the best cases I've had. Worst case, I would say just kind of going through how long it took to bring justice, the sacrifice that it took, not for me or the team necessarily, but our families, was the worst part. At the trial, we were down there over 2 months on the coast, not even talking about the months and years leading up to the trial. Everybody's family having to put their, you know, their livelihood or their lives aside and basically pick up the slack and, you know, be there for us and our families while we went down to the coast to get justice for this child. It was very tough in that regard. Also the worst in that because it took so long, it was, you know, this overarching, numbing type of, you know, thing that's there every day, all day, no matter what you're doing. It's in the back of your mind. And it took so long to be able to get it to an end point. That was very difficult to deal with, not being able to move on. Because I think a lot of times with our cases, even though they may take a while to get, you know, get to a verdict or get to a resolution, we do, and then we move on to the next one. In this case, it just took a while to get to that point, and it was tough. And then also looking at the, I guess, just that side of humanity, you know, looking at all the things that came out in this trial that had happened, that were going on, and being able to, or having to go through and address that and try to somehow, you know, compartmentalize it and not take it home. To your kids who have no idea this other world that's out there. And really, you don't want them to understand that this type of evil can exist.
Yeah.
And what about you, Vic? What made this your best and or worst case?
You know, it's somewhat similar to what Chuck said. I think the reason it was the best case scenario was there was a tremendous sense of a tremendous burden or weight on everybody in this office to achieve justice for this child. Normally in a case, in cases that I've prosecuted over the years myself as an assistant DA, there's somebody, a family member, a loved one, there's somebody that you can go back with and say, we did this, we achieved a justice in this case. This case was different. Cooper's mother stood by the defendant. Even though she divorced him, she stood by them. So we didn't have that aspect of being able to go back to the mother and say, we accomplished what we set out to accomplish. But in the end, we felt, and I certainly felt like as the elected, that the original goal that we set back on June 18th when this happened in 2014, of making sure, regardless of how long it took, that we achieved justice for this child. And we did. And so that made it the best case scenario. The worst case is, again, also a little bit similar to what Chuck said. The part about, you know, that I talked about the remarks or mean or ugly things about me as the elected, I'll be candid with you. I'm a pretty good page turner, and I turn that page pretty quick, and it doesn't really affect me or bother me. It didn't affect my decisions. But there was also a tremendous sense of weight on me because of my folks, my people, my staff, assuming the responsibility that they assumed in this case. You know, these are all people that I work with day in and day out. Even though we may have 130 folks in this office, the truth is, you know, I care about them. I care about Chuck and Jesse and Susan and everybody else who was down there. And realizing that their families are up here away from them when they have little children, children who are in school, children whose lives are moving on without their mom or their dad, it's tough. It's tough on me looking back and worrying about them, making sure they had everything they needed to be as comfortable as they could 300 miles away from their family. So because of that aspect of the case, it was probably one of the worst scenarios I'd been through as the elected.
Well, I know that for me, I just, you know, my hometown, my home office, I just want to thank you guys. I mean, it's really, I know what it's like to go through that, at least a little bit, to go through it. Certainly nothing of this high-profile nature have I ever done, but I understand what it's like to try child homicide, and I can only imagine that being Cooper Harris's only voice was a tremendous amount of pressure. And I just want you both to know that I, as a citizen here, and just as a former prosecutor and in person, really appreciate the job that you did. And most of the time, you probably don't get a lot of thanks in your job. You deal with defendants and defendants' families and victims of crime who may or may not be satisfied with how you've been able to resolve their cases. But I don't think you get a lot of thanks, but you certainly have mine.
Thank you.
Yeah, and my thanks too. We really appreciate you coming on Best Case, Worst Case with us and discussing this case that obviously has taken a toll on you and your families and coworkers. So we appreciate you bringing our listeners inside behind the courtroom lines this time and to basically tell us what it's like to live through something as a case as notorious as this. So we thank you very much for being part of it, and maybe we'll talk to you again sometime.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
So for now, we're signing off, and thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production, produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA, engineered and edited by Terrell Parham, music by Simba Sumba, and hosted by Wondery.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.